The next speaker, who is Mark.
Okay. Okay, my name's Mark, I'm an addict.
Hi, Mark.
It's good to be here. I feel really nervous, and I just want to say thanks, Amy. It was, I don't even know if I need this thing. Thank you, your share was great, and I was really touched through some of the share, and I just want to say welcome to the Russians, and it's great that you're here, and I always love... I always love in meetings where you hear different people from different countries, and it makes you realise that the fellowship is so big, you know, so a welcome, and maybe I'll see you in Russia sometime. So any newcomers, and if there's anybody here for the first time or really early in recovery, just keep, stay in the seat, keep coming to meetings, and, get, like what it says, we say, like, get a sponsor, get involved in service. There's reasons that we've got all these suggestions, and it's because it gets you right in the centre of the fellowship, and you can, it's much easier to stay clean if you're doing all that stuff, and also work the steps, because the programme is the 12 steps, so to get a sponsor and start doing the steps. So, I've just, it's fucking mad because on the way here, I was fine when I was going along the road on the bike, and I hadn't really thought I was going to meet Charlie here, and then when I got to the street, I could just feel the nervousness, and as I was sitting there, when Amy was sharing, I was just like, oh, come on, it's like waiting to go up the court or something to get a sentence, just get it done. So it's good once I start, and I know a lot of people here from different, it's good to see Leon and Michelle and people that I know from different settings as well, and I'm really proud to see them, staying clean and been clean for a while. It's fab. So just to give you a sort of synopsis around where I come from and, how addiction sort of manifested in my life and how my addiction can manifest still today without using drugs or alcohol, because let's get it right, you put down the drugs and alcohol, we're still addicts, we've still got an addictive personality, we can still create I can create dramas, believe me. So how it continues, but just also what the solution to that is and how important it is that I'm in some sort of solution where I'm working on stuff and I'm, so I grew up in Glasgow and my family, and I think this is a family illness. For me, my father was an alcoholic, my grandfather was an alcoholic, my mother was like workaholic. There was so much illness. Now I know Glasgow and Edinburgh Scotland full stop, and Ireland, I've got much more. It's like, they've done some stats around Scotland. They reckon that something like 60% or 70% of some of these council estates in Scotland are just rife with addiction, whether it's alcohol or whether it's drugs. But so I was around a lot of that, and as a kid, because I think watching my father and seeing what he was like, I definitely knew at an early age, I thought, I just don't want to be an alcoholic, because I was always putting him to bed, and I was, like, babysitting him a lot of the time, and I think I lost a lot of my childhood because I took on this role, I took this responsibility on of looking after him, but I was also a little thief. I mean, this is funny, when Amy was talking about her kids and stuff, I remember my dad, I remember going into Woolworths with them when I was a kid, and them saying, would you like in here? And I says, I like that gun, that gun there. And he says, all right, okay. And he just put his jacket open, he just put it in his jacket. And I remember as a kid just thinking, fucking hell, he's just like... And the adrenaline, as we're walking out the store, I was thinking, God, I hope he doesn't get caught, and so all that anxiety. But I think basically what I get shown was from a really early age that it's normal to do that type of behaviour. It's quite normal you know, to if you've not got a car, to steal someone else's, or so there's a whole thing around. And then what happened to me within that, what happened to me was that when I was 11, 12, I started to steal, and I was always really entrepreneurial. I was always, as a kid, I used to do a paper run, and I used to steal boxes of chocolate, fruit and nut, and whole nut. In fact, the last time I was up in Scotland, I went into this shop to see if it was the same owners, because I was going to make some sort of amend, but it was owned by somebody different. I thought, oh, I can't. I need to do it. But I used to go in and grab like boxes of fruit nut and whole nut and then take it to the school and then stand outside just along from the tuck shop and go, right, who wants fruit nut, who wants whole nut? You know, like, I'll give you half, you know, halfway. So from a young age, I had all that going on. And so it was inevitable, really. And I think when we talk about addiction, I think, you know, we talk about the illness, I think a lot of the traits were there. A lot of the traits were there before I picked up the drug or the drink. So a lot of that, there was a desperate need, and I can still feel this in my life today, that there's a underneath it, the core stuff is this codependency stuff, this love addiction, where I need something outside myself to fix that restlessness, that discontent inside. So whether that be a drink or a drug or a woman, a car, a job, you know, it's still underneath it, there's this thing that looks for the solution outside me and thinks that that will fix it. But of course, when I get the money or I get the woman, it lasts for a short period of time and I'm left with the thing. Now, there's either two things that can happen within that. Either I carry on with the same woman, or then what happens is, after a little bit of time, the head goes, well, actually, the grass is greener over there. I should be moving over to this. And this is the thing about addiction, is like this thing where you could continually do this type of behaviour where you're never really, you're always looking for the next thing. You're always looking for the next. And then, so it was like that from a young age, and I was really seeking approval from a young age, joining gangs in Glasgow. And I just want to say, Glasgow's a mad, I mean, it's the maddest city, I think. I mean, I've travelled in a lot of countries, South America, Colombia, Peru, I've been fucking mad. I was just in Jamaica a couple of weeks ago. And there's something about Glasgow, it's the only city that I'm ever really frightened in. And I don't know, because it's, because I just know how volatile the Glaswegians are. They're just like, you just go into a bar and you just, somebody looks at you and you just look at them the wrong way. They're just, you'll get headbutted or you'll get a bottle. I mean, it's always like, I don't want to portray a terrible picture of Glasgow. But it's rife with the thing. It's rife with it. Because basically you've got all these gangs, which I know come from all the Highland Clear and stuff. And so you've got all these gangs, and then you've got all the Celtic Ranger stuff, you know, where the sectarianism is rife as well. So you've got that, and then you've got the We Hate the English. The thing is, the We Hate the English thing was, I remember, I said this before, and I think the last year I've done here, but they put a car, they got a car, and they put an English flag on it, and they put it in Postle Park, this estate in Glasgow, which is like their office estate in Glasgow, and they took video footage of how long it would take for that car to get smashed up, and it was like, within 20 minutes, it was getting fucking, the tyres were getting slashed, just because it had the English flag in it. So there's a ancestral sort of type of, you know, resentment that's been there for hundreds of years, as well as, you know, all the sectarian. So you grow up in that sort of environment like that, you're getting fucking, it's just getting resentments all over the place. You don't like the MD, you don't like the Protestants, you don't like the rich people, you don't like the English, you don't like, you know, so it's a lot of stuff to work on. So anyway, I started taking drugs, and I was like, anyway. What else can you do, man? You know what I mean? It's like, you're snookered, man. There's nothing else you can do. I was like in trouble, so I as a young age, and I was a good, you know, like I was dedicated, and I've always been like this. I mean, like I was like, okay, if I'm going to take, you know, if I'm going to get, I remember when we all started smoking hash, I was always really, when Amy was talking, I was thinking about when guys in school were all starting to smoke hash, I was really curious. I mean, this was the sign. I mean, you should have seen then. The signs were all, the writing was on the wall. But I was like, I was really curious. And they would come back and you were all stoned and our eyes were all red. And I was thinking, God. And I says, what was it like? And they were like, oh, it's great, it's great. And so from an early age, I was really curious. And I got the great books of hashish. Once I started them, and I thought, okay, I'm going to go to these countries where the hash all grows. I'm going to go to smoke Nepalese temple balls and Kashmiri twist and all that. You know, like, I was fanatical about it, really. And I did, and this is the mad thing. I did get there. I mean, there was a lot of my use, and I never went to countries where there's no drugs, but I did go. So I went to India, I went away into the mountains, I went away. And sat with the locals, with loads of hash all around me, and I'd done the same in Morocco. But what happened with me was, which I couldn't see back then, and I dealt for years and stuff. I never really worked, so I just dealt, and I mean, I got arrested quite young, and then. But what was happening is which I couldn't see really. I thought that I was in control all the time. I thought that. Basically, I'm smoking dope and I'm taking acid and I'm going to take some opium. And, you know, and this is another thing. Everything that I say, when I was first started smoking dope, I remember thinking, this is all I am going to do. I am not going to be, because some of my pals were going to Edinburgh at the time. This was during the HIV epidemic, just before that, really. And I thought, I'm never going to, you know, everything that I said I would never do, I done, right? So I said, I'm never going to take LSD. I remember saying, I'm never going to take LSD. And I started taking mushrooms. And then once I started taking mushrooms, I thought, oh yeah, right, okay. What's wrong with taking a bit of LSD? And then I thought, I'll never take speed. And then I started taking a bit of speed. And then it was coke. And then it was heroin eventually. And so, and everything like, oh, and I'll never inject heroin. I injected heroin, you know. So every single sort of moral thing that I put down got smashed. And then... I'll tell you a story. This is quite interesting because I was thinking about this. I shared this at a convention recently and I started to share and I thought, it is a really good description of the step two, really, and the step three. When I was in India a couple of times, so I was, I wound up getting stuck in India, really. What happened is I couldn't leave India because the heroin was so cheap in India that I could not bear to think of coming back to England where you had to pay £100 a gram. Well, back then it was £100 a gram or £90 a gram. So I thought, fuck that. You know, like, there's no way I'm going back to England unless I can really avoid it. And anyway, so I kept reviewing my visas and I sussed out all these different scams you could do in India, so like bringing hash from the North India to the South India to Goa, taking electronic. I mean, there's loads of things that you can do. So what happened was these guys. I went to Thailand and I met these guys, and they said, "Oh, you know, you should bring hash from India the next time you're coming to Bangkok. Bring hash and we'll, you know, we can sell it and we can, you know, you can sell it because it's all grass in Thailand. I don't want you to do euphoric here about the thing, but it's all grass. So bring that and so I did. So I went back to India and I went up way up the mountains, got and swallowed, well, went back down to Delhi and then I got on the plane, swallowed all the hash, 300 grams of hash. I arrived in Bangkok, but I had a habit, right? So I had this, so by this time I had quite a serious heroin habit, which I'd known I've got a habit for ages, but I was completely reluctant to do anything about it because I still had money and things were still going quite well. So, as I thought at the time. So I get to Bangkok and I think, okay, I've got 300 grams of hash in my stomach. I've wrapped it in three layers of cling film, so I know somebody had told me, this is all nonsense really, because I don't know any of this was truth at all, it was just people had said certain things. So somebody had said to me, oh, for every layer of cling film, you've got 24 hours before the body acids destroy it, right? So I was thinking, I've got three layers around it, plus I dipped it in beeswax. So I'm in Bangkok now, and in Bangkok you just go to the chemist and get speed on. I mean, it's mad the place. So I'm there, and immediately I go to the snooker hall. There's a snooker hall in Koh San Road where I could score, so I scored some smack. And I thought, okay, I'll use it, I'll get some laxatives first thing in the morning. What I'll do is I'll just have a bit of gear now, and then the first thing in the morning I'll get the laxatives, I'll eat like mad, and I'll get this stuff out of me, right? So this was the first day. So the next morning I wake up and I just thought, and there was still a bit of smack left, I thought, no, I'll just finish the smack, and then I'll go and I'll get some Mekong, so I'll go and drink some whiskey and that, and then the next thing I think, oh God, you may as well just go, because I had this thing about the 3 days, and they think, so at the start, there was an urgency, there was a sort of urgency to get it out. By the third day, I was thinking, somebody somewhere had told me another thing, that hash, you can only get so stoned, you can only get... You can't die of the hash, right? So he said to me, so I had this in my head, this, you know, it was running around my head, and I was thinking, well, ruminating in my head, and I was thinking, okay, so I can't die, you can only get incredibly stoned. I mean, that's it. And I'd also been spiked once with lots of acid and about 15 trips or something, so I knew that I'd been through that and managed to come back out of it with still some sort of normality. So I thought, if I can get through massive trip, then hash can't be bad. So by the end of it, I was like, so but at the same time I was taking the laxatives, and I was thinking, and by the third day, right, I was in so much pain because I'd been eating all the time and taking laxatives and thinking, and I was in so much pain, and I remember going to the toilet. So I woke up like 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was just like, oh, I've got to... But of course, you can't go to the hospital and say, actually, by the way, I need to get this hash out or something. So, can you help me out with this? You know, because in Thailand, also, it's fucking death penalty for some of this stuff. So I'm in the toilet. Some of you will think it's a bit gross, but I'm just going to share it anyway. But why not, man? In for a penny, in for a pound. So I'm in the toilet, and you know, like in India, it's all they've got these hoses beside them. I've got it in my idea. The reason why it's all clumped up, like it's the beeswax. If I can just jet some water up there. So listen, I've stuck this hose up my arse, right? And I'm trying to shoot this water up, right? And then. And then I'm thinking, and then halfway through this, somebody must have been in the toilet before and they'd left their watch in the toilet, right? I mean, I don't know, it always sticks in my memories that I looked across and I seen a Timex watch on the side. I thought, God, what a result, man. Somebody's left their Timex watch. But, I mean, it's mad, isn't it? I mean, if things aren't bad, I think it's going to burst. I've got a fucking hole stuck up my heart. And I'm focusing on the watch. You know what I mean? I think life is fucking great because I found the time to go. So the long and short of it, man, is don't use beeswax. But I... But no, I got it out, and it just went boom, boom, boom. Anyway, I got it all out, and it was such a relief, man. But it's like that step two, and it's step two, and just to get any more step two or three than that, I don't want. But so what happened from there? I carried on using in 1996. I'm talking about recovery now, so I carried on using, and this is, I'll tell you what's really interesting is, I heard recently about, I can't remember if it was a share tape, but somebody said that basically everybody's rock bottom's the same because, I know what it was, yeah, I remember, it was Charlie gave me a share tape, and the guy was saying everybody's rock bottom's the same because we turn back to a higher power. He was basically saying it's that when you hit a rock bottom, And you ask, you cry out that I need help. I cannot do this on my own. I need help. And I had that experience in 96. I got clean in 96. In fact, this is why I'm doing the share, is because in 2 days I'm 15 years clean on Sunday.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So,
in 96, I was in this, and this is where it takes you, because, see, all of that stuff I was talking about, I mean, like, I was nuts. I was nuts when I was using. I wound up going away up to Chiang Mai and away up into, like, all. I remember once also, just to, this is the last using bit I'll give you. I remember I wound up and I met these English guys and they said, oh, why don't you, this is in Bangkok, says, why don't you, if you really like heroin, don't heroin so much, but if you really want to get heroin really cheap, why don't you go way up to the borders of Burma and Laos? I says, okay, whereabouts, where's the, where did you go to? And they says, oh, there's a village that's away up. So here's me, away up on my own, Chiang Mai, Chiang Rai. And then I get a motorbike and I'm going through all this and I've not got a clue. I mean, I've not got a clue where I'm going really, but I know I've got this thing, mate. And I get to this town and I'm the, they don't get tourists in this town. There's no one, they can't speak any English. There's no shops or nothing. And I get to this guy's, and it's just like a wee coffee shop. It's not even a coffee shop. It's just where the locals all come and play dominoes and drink hooch. And so I've got this guy's name. And so I get there and I say to him, oh, John and Terry from Bangkok, the English guy sent me because you can get me heroin really cheap. And he says, yeah, how much do you want? I says, oh, 50, get me 50 grams of heroin, please. And I give him the money and he goes off. And every day I'm sitting there with this guy, I mean, for ages, it must have been 4 or 5 weeks at least, and every day, and he's got a big glass syringe, and we're just shooting up, me and him are just shooting up. But every night, we're sitting there playing dominoes, I'm playing dominoes with all these mad, it's just all these ties, and he keeps saying to me, do you not want a woman? This is another thing he says, because do you not want a Thai woman? Do you not want a woman? She can wash her clothes, she can do this, you can have sex. And I was just like, you know, no. No, I don't, because the sex drive had completely gone. There was no, the priority was just the drug. I mean, it soon comes back, as soon as you're clean, of course, but I but then it was like, so, yeah, 96, in this toilet, St. Thomas's Hospital, my friend to the HIV, he used to give me amps, these diamorphine amps, so I meet up with him. I have a hit in the toilet in St. Thomas's Hospital. I don't go over, I just gouch off, but I come to and the lights are out in the toilet, but I don't know the lights are out, because it's just dark. So I come to and I think I'm blind. But then I see there's a light at the bottom of the door, I see a light, and I go, oh, right, so I'm alive. I'm alive, but I'm not blind. So I see the light, and then I was sitting there in the toilet seat, and I was thinking, this is just, you know, I need to stop. I need to really, and I did, my spirit, I was just really crying out inside, because I was 32 years old, I'd been using, I'd never got clean. I'd been in prison a couple of times, I'd been in prison in Spain, I mean, in different countries, been in prison, but so the next thing I do that, and then a few months later, I wound up getting arrested. And then the whole process starts to go to rehab. Now, this is the thing. When we were in detox and rehab, I had no idea. I had no idea about the recovery. My dad had been in AA for ages, and he kept slipping and stuff. So I didn't really know what was required. But I also, something that happened was I came to the London Convention in 97, and there was a woman sharing, and it was really powerful for me, because there was a woman sharing on it was either the Friday, I think it was the Saturday night, and she was talking about, when she was sharing, she was talking about that she had came into recovery, and then she was really frightened to go for a check to see if she had the virus, and she waited for 2 years or 3 years to go for the test, and then when she went, she found out she was positive, HIV positive. So she was sharing this on the stage, and there was something about it. I was, if you think, I was so new to recovery. I was really like, I was just taking everything in, and I knew, I also knew that the using's over. I can't go back, but I don't know what's in front. And she was sharing, and she broke down in tears on the stage. And there was a group of guys just behind me, and one of them shouted up, and they were all, you know, like lads, really, and they were just like, and one of them shouted up, "We love you," to this woman, because she started crying on the stage. And there was something that happened in that moment when he shouted, "We love you," she heard it on the stage. This was in Goldsmiths College, and she heard it, and she sort of started carrying on her share, stopped crying, she smiled and she carried on her share. But in that moment, I could feel this energy that all directed towards, because I think what has happened is the guy was the catalyst. He just said what a lot of people were probably thinking. And I really believe this. This is the thing that keeps me coming to meetings, is that I can feel sometimes in meetings that therapeutic value of one added to helping another. That love that I feel is what brings me to meetings and keeps me in meetings, because I could feel that time, and I thought, wow, this is really special. And there was something else that happened. There was a spiritual thing where I thought, I am completely meant to be in this spot. I am not meant to be anywhere else in the world. I'm meant to be completely here listening to this share. And it was really powerful. And then on the Sunday, there was a little guy from Harlem came and done a share. His name was Melvin. And he was great, man. He came and he'd done a lot of that stuff around. He said, look, if you get into a relationship and you've not done a step 4 and 5, you've got 6 people in the relationship. You've got who you think you are, who she thinks you are, and who you actually are. And she's got the same. She's got who she thinks she is, who she actually is, and who you think she is. That's 6 people. The wrong 2 will always show up. And, you know, like, he started doing, and he was like, he was really good. And he said also about if you've been in the fellowship for a year and you've not got a service commitment, you could well be a thief. You know, like, so he started to, like, say, you know, come on, you should be getting involved. And so that turned things around for me. And I, you know, I came back from that and I fired into the steps, and I just want to say it's not all been one straight journey, because I think it's impossible. There's been times in recovery I've just went right off the programme. I've been like clean but not working. I've always went to meetings, I've always been sort of involved, I've done often a lot of H&I and stuff, and I've always had some service commitments, but at times my illness has also been very strong in a different area, and it does, and it manifests in so many. I mean, I could get addicted to it, but I think anything that gives me some sort of pleasure, I'm on it like a shot, you know. And so I've been dishonest, and I've been, you know, all sorts of mad stuff. But the long and short of it is, I've learned so much around that. I can't screw. The longer I've went on, the more I've thought, God, you cannot mess around with this illness. And I'm really surprised. When I look back, I think, God, I was so lucky to, you know, I'll just share, because I just think it's important that when I was 5 years clean, I went to Peru, and I was nuts right back then. Right, when I think back, that when I look back, I was in Peru. I was doing loads of kickboxing classes, because that was a wee, you know, I was thinking, oh, kickboxing, just get out and bother me. It's fucking mad. It's mad. There's this sort of mad logic that goes on in my head sometimes where I think, oh, just in case you ever have to go back out there again, you should get yourself a tool. You know what I mean? You should get your. There's this fucking craziness, you know what I mean? And so I'm doing all these kickboxing classes, and I'm in Peru, and I'm walking up. And I'm in the grip of there's sex stuff going on, right? So I'm in this nightclub, right? And I'm determined, right? So I'm single, but I'm in this nightclub in Cusco, this place called Cusco. And I've got addiction, right? And I'm trying to chat up these different women. But, you know, the music's blaring. You know, it's music's blaring. I'm like, oh, Dundee S, did it, you know, like trying to think. I'm having no joy, right? And I'm in the grip of it, right? I'm determined because I've got this preoccupied head. So once I've got my targets on the thing, I'm, you know, I can't seem to move myself away from it. I'm just locked in. It's like, so I can't leave. But it's getting late and I'm thinking, just late. So anyway, I leave eventually the nightclub, but it's 1:30 in the morning. And I've walked up, I've came out, and I'm walking up this road, and there's this thing which has happened to me all through my life, really. I've got this thing today, there's a thing about danger, and there's a thing about, it was like it when I was in Jamaica a couple of weeks ago, I wanted to get downtown, and the guy, taxi driver, was going, no, you don't want to go downtown, man, they'll shoot you, man. And I'm like, oh, but come on, you know, let me get shot. It's a weird, and I felt such a loss after it. I says, well, where can you take me then? It's ghetto. And he says, well, I'll take you to Spanish town. And I was like, okay, is it good? Is it going to be good enough? So this was what was happening a wee bit in Peru, but I've also got this mad, so there's this mad obsession stuff going on around the women. There's also the mad stuff going on around the kickball. So I see these three guys, and the three guys come out of this alleyway. I'm walking up, and immediately I think, fucking, I know these characters are out robbing people. It's without a shadow of a doubt they're robbing people. Because I used to rob people myself, so I know what they look like. And so I'd spot them 10 eyes out, and I sort of like, okay, right, so I need to just go that way. They're there, my hotel's up here, I need to just do a square thing, so I just need to keep my eye on them. So I go right, and I'm walking, I almost like smile at them, but in my head, I'm going along, thinking, don't worry about them, man, Peruvians. They're quite small. You can just go bang, bang, bang. You know, I've worked it out in my head how, when one of them come up, how I'm going to hit them, and, you know, all this stuff that's going on. And I'm walking along, and there's no fear. I don't know what's going on. There's no sort of fear that, you know, but although there's this other thing, there's my hairs on the back, my neck are standing up, because the part of me, the animal part, knows you're in danger. You're in serious danger. Anyway, to cut a long story short, the next thing is cab turns up, and it's like, and I've been warned, and this is the thing about higher power. I really believe you hear things at certain times. Like when I first arrived in Peru, I was just leaving this in Lima. I was just leaving this hotel, and this guy was just going out as I was coming in. And I says, "Oh, did you go to Machu Picchu?" He says, "Yeah, yeah." He says, "Be careful of taxis." That's all he said. Be careful of taxis. I went, "Oh, that's strange." He says, "Be careful." And then, so I carried on my own little dream world as usual, and then just went. And then that night, a taxi comes along, and I just think, oh, right, okay, that's the solution. Jump in the taxi, you can get past the guys. But I don't know the taxi driver's linked with the same three guys. They're working in the partnership. So I get in the taxi, and as soon as I get in the taxi, these three guys just go, and they're in both sides, and one's in the front. So I'm stuck in this taxi with these three guys. Now, as this guy's getting in there, I've tried to kick him in the mouth as he's getting in, but he's got a big kitchen knife, and he just puts the kitchen knife round, and he puts it in my throat, and he says in Spanish, "Morte, gringo, you know, De Niro." But all the way through, I'm quite calm. It's bizarre, because actually, there's a part of me, and this is another part, is that I was thinking, I've got £400 in my money belt, because I didn't trust the hotel to leave the money in the hotel, because it was a dodgy hotel. So I carried the money with me, but I'd left credit cards there. So when they went quite quickly, as soon as they get in, I thought, I've got to part with some money here. I'm going to have to part with some money, but I don't want to part with much money at all, right? In fact, I want to give the fucking bare minimum. I only want to give them really £20, and they should be grateful, really. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to take one of the 20s out, right? I'm like, and he's like pushing it, he's got in, because obviously I think we're going to just fleece a lot from you. You're not going to chance. So I'm trying to take a 20, and every time I try to get that out, he's like pushing the knife a wee bit more into my neck. Anyway, I get out and I'm stuck. Now, by this time, I'm miles away outside the town. He's taken me to this, where it's just all an old river running down, which is all dried up, and a couple of huts just scattered around, and it's darkness. And they've got a lot of time now, and they're going, oh, I'm from Chile, and he's from Peru, but he's from Argentina. I mean, I remember it as if it's like yesterday. And I'm saying, I'm trying to speak in broken Spanish, saying, guys, I know what it's like to be in this situation. You know, I'm trying to tell them that I'm an addict, right? And that I know your situation, and I've robbed people before, similar to what you're doing this now, but not in cars in Peru, but obviously, but I've robbed, and they're just nuts, you know what I mean? So they take all the money, thank you, and they leave, then they take me out of the car, and they come behind me and they start to strangle me. Now, this is the point where I really started to freak out, because I realised then, I thought, oh, actually, they're going to kill me, because I didn't know that they strangle people when they leave them unconscious, because so that you can't see the number plate of the cars, it's going away. But so I'm thinking that they're, and I can't, and no matter, I could be the best kickboxer in the world, there's no way I was going to overcome them. So I'm getting strangled, and in my head, as I'm getting strangled and I'm losing, I can't breathe, I'm thinking, this is it, this is no meant to happen like this, this is, you're 5 years clean, it's not meant to end, surely it's not, it's mad really, surely it's not meant to end like this, this is like, you know, this is no meant to happen, and, but of course, then I kid on that I'm dying. So then I decide, another voice says to me, just kid on that you're dead. So I just kidded on that I was dead, so I just slumped a bit, and then I must have went unconscious and I woke up. Now, when I woke up, they'd taken everything. They'd taken the shoes from my feet, they'd taken the belt from my... Still, my T-shirt was all dirty, and the jeans were rolling around in the mud, but they'd taken everything away from me, and I didn't know where the town was and stuff. So I seen a light on in one of these huts, and I sort of was... best I could walk all the rocks and all that, and I'd got to the thing, I banged on the door, I was like, help, 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 Robbo, Robbo, and they turned the light off, right, and this is this best day in recovery, your worst day in recovery is better than your best day using thing, right, because I really get that, you know, synopsis around, you know, because we're clean and all that, you know, it's better than, I had some great days using, believe me too, you know, not at the end, but earlier on I had some good days. But I think I was just like, and they turned the light off, and I was just like, I had to get back to this town. Anyway, on the way back, because I'll need to finish soon, but on the way back, it was really funny. These two guys, because they sell coca, they dip coca leaves in water, and they heat it up like coca tea. And when I was coming back, the first people that I met offered me, they said, oh, do you want, and the first thing they offered me was this coca mate, and I said, no, I says, no, because I'd avoided it when I was in Peru, and then I get back to town, but also just on the end of that thing was that when I had to go to some meetings because I was in post-traumatics, after it I was in shock, right, when I got back to the hotel, I realised that I was completely fine during the whole thing, but when I got back to the hotel, I was looking around in the toilet, making sure there was nobody in the toilet. I was just off key. So I went to a meeting, and a couple of days later, I went to a meeting in Lima, and we're really lucky in this country, because the meeting that I went to in Lima was in a psychiatric unit, because what happened back then, like 10 years ago, a lot of people who have drug or alcohol problems just get nutted off, really. They you know, they just, as soon as you've got a drug, so they took, I went into this hospital, and it was like, it was a mad thing, because I wound up knocking on the door, and I says, Don DS, Narcotics Anonymous, and the big matron came, and she says, yeah, see, come here, and she took me down this long corridor, and there was all cells on each side, and the latches were open, and there was people just going outside the door. And I remember just thinking, God, this is not, this is crazy. I've just come out of that trauma, and I hope you don't, you know, because I was still sort of stressed out from the whole experience before. And I thought, God, anyway, I went into the meeting, and lots of people in the meeting, and it was I've never experienced, because the meeting room was, because a lot of the inpatients had went in there, and from a psychiatric point of view, they were probably okay to begin with, but because they were in there for a while, they'd started to develop mental health problems. So half the meeting had mental health problems, and the other half were like, you know, so... but they'd done all these drawings on the wall, a big NA hat, a big NA symbol, and a hand going down and reaching. And it was just really, really powerful, the meeting, and I was really glad to connect in here. The last thing I want to share about is just that, you know, basically I go to bed at night time in the solution most of the time. I go to the bed every night really in recovery. I wake up with the illness every morning. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it is. It's like Anthony always says. He says it's like living with this disease is like living with a flatmate who never goes out. It's the illness is always there, and I just wanted to sort of share that. Really, I've had such joy in recovery. I've had some hard times, but my life does not compare to. I mean, the quality of my life now does not compare to my using life. My using life was no life whatsoever. But my illness in recovery wants to... It's like a game of chess. Every move that I make forward, the illness makes a move. And I think the illness, what it wants to do is get me back into a place where I'm not living my life. Now, if that is not living my life through some other form of addiction, right, or whether that's drug or alcohol, it doesn't really matter. Whether it's... whatever type of addiction, whether it's a gambling addiction, whether it's a sex addiction, but it's the mission of my illness is to get me into a place of pain and to keep me in a place of pain. And what recovery shows me is a solution that if I work these steps and if I continue on this trajectory, this I can have freedom. And I just wanted to just, you know, I've got two beautiful children today. I've got a lot of love in my life. I've got some brilliant pals. I was just in New York and LA with Charlie and a few other people. And I mean, it's wonderful. I've had such blessings. But I also know that most of my friends that I came into recovery with are either using or they're dead. And I've buried them along the way because they started to gamble and then started to drink at 10 years and such like clean. So I know that it's also can be a lonely path the longer you're in. But I have to keep on building new networks and new friends and new people and you know and share. Thanks for letting me share. Cheers.
In NA, we celebrate clean time with keyrings, claps and hugs. For that, I'm going to hand it back to tonight's speakers.
All right, Amy. What do you want to do, Amy? Do I do the first? Right, okay, yeah. In any way, shout...
We celebrate,
but I'm not going to do it, because it's 2 days away. It's 2 days. Okay, so bad woman.